Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Elizabeth Currid Halkett, author of The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Elizabeth, welcome to The Bookmonger.
It is wonderful to be on your show. Thank you, John.
You're a professor at the University of Southern California. You live in Los Angeles. What made you want to write a book about the people who live in the small towns of flyover country?
Well, it's a great question, John. And one of the things that was clear to me growing up in what you call flyover country, what's kind of the common vernacular when we think about these states, was that these folks are amazing, beautiful people. And just as interesting as those who reside in our coastal cities. I was born in West Virginia. My parents are Irish immigrants, and that's where they arrived. And when my mom finished her residency, she had a choice to go to a really fancy teaching hospital affiliated with Harvard, and a rural hospital in small town Pennsylvania. And, you know, they had three young children and not a lot of money, and they did the math, and my mom accepted the position in rural Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up, and it was a small town of 5,000 people, still is. And so I have always had very warm memories about where I grew up, even though I ended up going to school in Pittsburgh and then graduate school in New York, and I work in Los Angeles. And I think for me, what prompted the book was, you know, after Trump was elected to the White House, there was this reckoning, it seemed, right? I mean, you know, it was like all of these articles about how we didn't understand rural America. They were so angry. They were full of rage. I mean, I remember that, you know, even in Los Angeles, like talking to colleagues and friends who lived in these, you know, coastal elite cities and were educated at the finest institutions, and you're talking about, you know, these kind of awful people who voted for Trump. And I just didn't think that that was true. In fact, I knew it wasn't true. I grew up in this place. I knew these people. I knew that a lot of them voted for Trump, but I thought that there was a different story, and that was what I wanted to find out.
And so what did you learn as you did your research into rural America?
So I looked at rural America from a few different angles. So I did the data crunching. Like I looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics data and census data and Nielsen consumption data. I looked at data on health. And this picture emerged with a lot of the data that rural America was doing better than you would think. So in some ways, it really challenged the stereotype that rural America was left behind. It had no jobs. It had no homeownership. It was poor. That is true of certain parts of the country, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. The South is in real trouble. Parts of Appalachia are in real trouble. But a lot of rural America is doing great. It's a wonderful life to live in Iowa. And also, you know, for me, data is only part of the story. It doesn't get you a sense of the humanity. And so I just talked to dozens and dozens of people who lived in these small towns, and this different story emerged. I mean, yes, some of them voted for Trump and some of them voted for him twice. And some of them, you know, might have been huge fans of his. And yet, despite the liberal narrative, they were really nice, decent humans. So this kind of idea that like voting for President Trump was some sort of sign of, you know, being an awful person or morally compromised or whatever sort of way in which the liberal media talked about those voters was just not true. And then there was also this thing that I think we ignore in the political system here, which is that you get a vote. And if you're a slightly more conservative person, you're more than likely going to vote for the Republican. And if you're a slightly more liberal person, you're going to vote for the Democrat. And, you know, never mind the people at the tails. But the point being that we had ascribed too much emotion to these votes. And Trump became this kind of cult of personality for folks, which was really a straw man. Because if you actually look at data, and this isn't my research, this is research done by others, if you look at data on rural voting patterns, they've been marching towards Republicans increasingly decade after decade. The vote for President Trump was just a part of a time series of voting more conservatively. So I just think it was more what was going on than this emotive explanation that the liberal media was really embracing.
So are you saying we make too much of the political divisions between urban and rural America, and that in fact both areas share a lot of American values?
100%, John. The thing that really was extraordinary to me when I talked to rural Americans was, you know, I wouldn't find out until halfway through our interview, and these were, you know, hour, 2 hour interviews, if they were Republican or Democrat. And I couldn't have told you until they told me. So when you ask people, how do you feel about democracy and family life and the environment and equality in this country? Most people have really sensible, decent answers. And we lose track of that decency and openness that most Americans possess when we focus on whether they're Democrat or Republican, and the way in which the media kind of weaves the story of division. You know, that's just not the truth when you get down to a human level with another person, and when you connect with them, you're like, oh, we have a lot in common. And even if I don't agree with you, I get where you're coming from. It's really important to not lose sight of that in all of our like statistics and percentages and, you know, voting results. I mean, there's just a deeper thing going on with us as Americans.
I'm going to guess that if we look at, say, church-going patterns between people who live in cities versus people who live in small towns, that folks who live in small towns are much more likely to go to church than people who live in cities. Is that true or is that wrong?
Actually, not true. One of the things that was extraordinary was, of course, I talked to lots of people, but you always, as a social scientist, you want some other macro data. And so I looked at the University of Chicago's General Social Survey. So they've been surveying for decades, like on all sorts of different topics, and one of them being religion. And what their data suggests is that urban and rural folks have largely similar views on God and spirituality and attendance in religion. You might have a little more attendance in rural towns, but really not that much. I mean, nothing meaningful. Even down to how many times does a person pray a day, it's not very different between these two geographies. And it really was interesting to me because I was really surprised when I saw this data, because the rural folks I talked to were so open about their belief in God and the role of the church in their community. And urban folks that I interviewed weren't. And being someone who's lived in a city now for almost two decades, like I was skeptical because I thought, wow, well, you know, I don't have friends and colleagues who talk openly about their religious beliefs, but the statistics suggest that they're just as religious. And it got me thinking about this concept of cultural capital, which is this sort of accrual of your knowledge and your resources, your information, your tastes. And I wrote my last book on this idea of cultural capital and social mobility, that particular forms of cultural capital, you play piano, you speak a few languages, you go to Yale, were really important to social mobility. And if you didn't possess them, you were sort of out of the kind of global elite meritocrat class. And one of the things that was so fascinating about working on this book was, first of all, everyone has cultural capital. It's just different. And second, people in rural America don't necessarily want to be a part of the meritocratic rat race in our coastal cities. Like, they're just content with their own cultural capital. And religion is a part of that. It's because it's so central to small town life. It's the place where you meet people and communicate and talk and share ideas and run errands and all sorts of things that are so important to community are linked to religion in small towns in a way that they're less so in urban areas.
One more question. We hear so much about how America is divided today, and usually we mean politically divided, but we mean a lot of other things when we say that too. How do we overcome these divisions between urban and rural America, even if they're only based on false perceptions? How do we overcome that?
It's a wonderful question. I wish I had a definite answer, but I'll give you what I think insofar as it's worth anything. The two things that I really took away from my research were as follows. One, I think on a more kind of concrete level, we need to ignore the tales more. I think that both the extreme left and the extreme right are telling this story that most Americans assume is the story of the left and the right and divided, whereas actually most people are fairly moderate. And if we can remember that, and if actually the, and if, frankly, if the media can spend a little more time on those ordinary Americans, they will find that this story, this country is so much more cohesive and connected. So I think that's a real thing that we can do. The other thing on a practical level, and it is complicated, but I think we need to create greater access to the types of news that everyone can get access to. Because a really good high-quality journalism has paywalls and is expensive. And so people often get their news kind of misinformation, you know, if you're getting it on YouTube or on Facebook or whatever, and you're not getting access to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the National Review. And so if we can figure out ways that those become greater public goods, I think that would be great. And then the final thing is, you know, a more sort of existential takeaway. But I think if we could just look at each other as human beings with kids and excitement about holidays and caring about the environment and other human beings, if we can actually just get in the frame that most people are like that, just like most of us are, then we would have a softer, I think, kinder or more compassionate view towards those Americans who aren't exactly like us, but, you know, still are, you know, wonderful human beings as well.
The author is Elizabeth Currid Halkett. The book is The Overlooked Americans, The Resilience of Our Rural Towns and What It Means for Our Country. Elizabeth, thanks for joining The Bookmonger.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.